This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Columbus police just confirmed what a lot of people kind of suspected was going to be coming, the way the Tepe story has been playing out. They found the murder weapon, not in a river, not in a dumpster, three states away, in a place that's going to be really, really difficult to argue. Michael McKee's apartment, allegedly. His Chicago penthouse in Lincoln Park. A vascular surgeon, board certified. No criminal history, no malpractice claims. Just allegedly one seething jealousy and anger that he could never quite get over after being dumped by his wife almost a decade ago. He allegedly drove almost 300 miles in the middle of the night to execute said ex-wife and her husband, then drove home and kept the gun. Yeah. Niven matched the shell casings recovered from Spencer and Monique Tepe's bedroom to a firearm seized from McKee's residence, allegedly. Multiple weapons recovered, exposed through a federal ballistics database designed to connect guns to crime scenes. And here's the part that should kind of make you pause. He allegedly held on to that weapon for 11 days, went back to work, did shifts, lived his life with a gun that police say killed two people sitting somewhere in his apartment. Who does that? Who commits double homicide and doesn't ditch the weapon? Someone with one hell of an ego. Someone who thinks very highly of themselves. Someone who thinks so highly of themselves that their anger, that their jealousy, that their self-importance, that their ego, because it was bruised so badly through a breakup that so many people go through, he couldn't get over in 8 years, that it somehow warranted allegedly murdering the ex-wife and her husband, despite the fact that she's moved on and has created two new human beings with said new husband. But your feelings overshadow that. You were burned too badly. Whatever the hell happened here. But I'm telling you, the evidence is pretty much pointing in one direction, unless this is one hell of a conspiracy. Who does that? A fucking narcissist does that. That's who does that. You know, we say it too much on this show. All roads lead to narcissism. Well, here's another. It may get worse. According to Law and Crimes reporting, McKee reportedly gave police an alibi that didn't hold up either. Standard procedure in a homicide, detectives call the ex first, just checking boxes. Where were you December 30th? Simple question. McKee reportedly answered, didn't lawyer up right away, didn't invoke his rights, just talked, even gave a story. And according to reports, that story has fallen apart. He only went silent after the cuffs went on, and by then, whatever he'd already said was on the record. So basically, if he did this, he gave a bullshit story, thought so highly of his story, so highly of his genius, of his self, that they're never going to question this, they're never going to look into it, that there was no backup plan. No way to have an alibi. Just, I'm going to say this aloud. When it doesn't pan out, well, they're never going to look. Who does that? A fucking narcissist. Like extreme, like disorder all the fucking way. Or a sociopath or a psychopath. And lucky for you, that borderline narcissistic personality disorder, it's like right next to all of those. And quite often, sociopaths and psychopaths share many of those same traits. So we're probably a little more into that sort of territory, the sociopathic type territory, than we are narcissism. But if this starts to sound familiar and traits start to sound familiar, it's because he has them. At least observationally, he does, from my vantage point. I'm not a doctor. I'm not diagnosing. All opinion. So they got the cuffs on him, and then he didn't talk. By then, whatever he'd already said was on the record. And if forensics contradict that story, if his DNA is in that house, if his hair or fibers are on those bodies, he's potentially boxed himself into a corner he can't talk his way out of. You don't talk yourself out of a murder investigation. You only talk yourself deeper into one. The arrest itself reads like something out of a film that takes itself too seriously. Saturday morning, January 10th, McKee's coming off an overnight shift at the hospital in Rockford, drives 7 minutes down the road to a Chick-fil-A, maybe grabbing breakfast, maybe killing time before the 80-minute drive back to Chicago. And guess what? ATF is ready for you, waiting. Arrested without incident, booked in the Winnebago County Jail at 11:57 a.m. Wonder if he made it for lunch or breakfast at the Chick-fil-A. Hands and feet chained, yellow jail suit. He's calm, no emotion, barely spoke except to confirm his name. You know, he's putting out that aura of control, of confidence. Why ATF? Well, because Nibin is their system. That's the system that identified the weaponry. And if McKee crossed state lines with a firearm to commit murder, that's federal jurisdiction. That's their lane. It becomes a federal crime. Searching, getting taken down at a fast food restaurant, that's where this story landed. But here's where it gets even more uncomfortable. At a press conference, a reporter asked Columbus police a question that hung in the air. Neighbors said they saw McKee in the neighborhood and in front of the Tepe home days before the homicide. Can you confirm? Chief Elaine Bryant's answer, at this time, we're unable to talk about specific information, so they didn't deny it. And then there's December 19th. 11 days before the murders. What happened there? We're going to get to that, but I want you quickly, if we've not done so already, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this program, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever it is. If you're enjoying this reporting, hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our videos on this and the many cases we cover. And I want to get your thoughts. So join in this conversation off the air in the comment section on YouTube, or directly with me on our Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description. It's absolutely free right now, and you get access to all of our reporting a day in advance. A little extra there, and no ads right now, all for a limited time. You can check that out. So, December 19th, 11 days before the murders, reports surfaced of someone pounding on a neighbor's door at 2:30 in the morning. Same neighborhood. Kind of weird. Whether that's connected to this case, we don't know. Police haven't addressed it. But the timing raises questions. But it is Chicago. There's also the question of contact. A reporter asked if McKee and Monique had any communication leading up to the murders. Brian Hedge, there are some things we can't share for investigative purposes. But you did confirm one thing. No police reports were ever filed from the Tepe address about Michael McKee. No 911 calls, no restraining orders, nothing official. That doesn't mean he wasn't reaching out, though. It means if he was, she never reported it. The family is finally talking as well, and what they're saying fills in gaps that police haven't. Rob Misley is Spencer Tepe's brother-in-law. He said Monique never called Michael McKee by name after the divorce, not once in 8 years. She only referred to him as her ex-husband, like saying his name would summon something she'd spent years trying to escape. Michael McKee, Michael McKee, Michael McKee, and then boom, it's like fucking Beetlejuice. Who has an ex that you feel that way about, huh? You're just like, don't say their name. Ms. Leigh called him a monster. Said Monique talked openly about the emotional abuse, that threatening behavior. And she was willing to do anything to get out of there. like so many people do when they're being emotionally abused. And then this, she was always worried about him, but we never thought it seemed like a direct threat. 8 years she spent. 8 years looking over her shoulder, building a new life, a new husband, new kids, her kids, new home, and still always worried. When McKee was arrested, the family told reporters it was absolutely not a shock to anybody. They'd suspected him from day one, kept their mouths shut so they wouldn't compromise the investigation, waited, watched. The arrest came hours before Spencer and Monique's funeral. And the family exhaled. The question everyone keeps asking, why now? They divorced in 2017, 8 years ago. It's almost a decade. They had no kids together, no ongoing custody battle, no financial entanglement. On paper, they were done. It could have technically been basically annulled because it was so short. But he didn't want to participate in that, and so she had to get a freaking divorce. It should have been done nearly a decade ago. So what broke? Now, police are calling this a targeted domestic violence attack. That's the official language, but they haven't disclosed motive. Not yet. So what we can piece together? This was an impulsive. McKee allegedly drove 300 miles, got into the house without forced entry, shot Spencer multiple times, shot Monique at least once in the chest, left two children, a four-year-old and a one-year-old, alive in separate rooms, then allegedly just drove home and went back to work. Prior calculation and design, that's what the charges say. The theories floating around all point to the same thing, holiday isolation. The pressure of January, social media, watching your ex post photos of her beautiful family, her successful husband, her kids. Maybe he reached out and she shut him down. Maybe the rejection was enough. Who knows? Maybe he just sat there for 8 years, sulking, being a wound collector, being the pathetic individual that he is, only able to show his worth on paper. With his academics, with his expertise. It's a lot of work to become a surgeon. It's really sad when that's all you have to show for yourself because you're morally, ethically, and emotionally bankrupt and devoid of humanity. But unfortunately, we see this all too often. We see it quite often in very high-performing individuals. And in no way am I saying every high-performing individual is doing. No, not at all. Plenty lovely folks. But why? Why do we see this? Because the high performance is a mask. Because they can't figure it out over here. There's some deficit over here. A deep emotional deficit that they can't attain. And it's not always just because they're naturally horrible human beings. There probably is something going on in that brain that's making it very difficult to feel emotions the way the rest of us feel emotions. And to mask that, to show that I'm worth something, that I'm good, because chances are there's probably a lot of childhood trauma, a lot of rejection. They go to such extremes in the professional world. To show, oh my God, look how amazing I am. That's pretty impressive. But that still doesn't fix the void, and that doesn't fix what's missing over here. And unless that can actually be addressed and dealt with, that will always come back to haunt. And maybe that's what took place here. That grudge finally hit critical mass. Some people hold on to anger like a savings account, compound interest, 8 years of deposits, and then one day they cash it all in. The divorce documents tell a story, if you know how to read them. Married in August of 2015, separated 7 months later, divorced by June 2017, she filed, grounds were incompatibility. On the surface, it looks clean, fast, uncontested, but some details do stick. McKee listed her engagement ring and wedding band as his separate property. She wasn't even fighting for them. He wanted them back anyway from a seven-month marriage. The separation agreement required her to reimburse him $1,281.59 for miscellaneous debt with an interest clause if not paid on time, like credit card. It's like something. It's like 24% or something per month. It was nuts. Like, nobody does this. This is insane. Her financial affidavit listed his bank account as unknown. His pension was unknown. He handled the finances. She wasn't privy to the details. He signed everything in advance, didn't show up for the final hearing, divorce granted as an uncontested default. One lawyer handled the whole thing, hers. He signed the waiver saying he understood he wasn't represented. On paper, it looked amicable, but the details tell a different story. On the morning of December 30th, it unfolded like this in 2026. At 8:58 a.m., Spencer's boss called 911 from vacation in Florida. Spencer didn't show up to work. Can't reach him, can't reach his wife. His words, we can't get in touch with his wife, which is probably the more concerning thing. Why would coworkers be worried about his wife? Then at 9:22, police dispatched for a welfare check. They go to the house, wrong address, knock on the wrong door, check the wrong backyard. The chief later confirmed the officer did everything he was supposed to do at the wrong house. So right off the bat... Jesus Christ. You have one job. 9:57 a.m., a friend arrives at the correct address, looks through the window, sees Spencer's body on the floor next to the bed, blood everywhere, hears children screaming inside. At 10:11 a.m., Spencer and Monique Tepe were pronounced dead. At the scene, Spencer was found shot multiple times. Monique shot at least once in the chest, 3 9-millimeter shell casings on the floor, no forced entry, nothing stolen, nothing ransacked, 2 children alive in separate rooms, and the dog was unharmed. It was a targeted hit, clean, deliberate. And then whoever did it walked away. So who is Michael McKay? I said, on paper, he's an accomplished 39-year-old man, vascular surgeon, Ohio State undergrad, Ohio State Medical School, completed his residency in 2020, licensed in Illinois and California, living in Lincoln Park, Chicago, no criminal record, no disciplinary actions, traffic tickets only. His neighbors in Chicago described him as a normal guy, friendly, talked about the weather at the rooftop pool, seemed fine. The family describes something else entirely, a monster, emotionally abusive, threatening, the kind of person you spent 8 years trying to forget. 2 completely different men, depending on who you ask. And there's still a lot the police are not saying. Full motive, communications between McKee and Monique before the murders, whether he was surveilling the house in the days leading up to the December 30th, digital forensics, GPS data, phone records, anything that tracks his movements, there's a lot to come. One thing worth watching, a reporter at the press conference implied McKee may have remarried at some point. No documentation has surfaced to confirm that. Could be nothing, could be something. We'll keep digging. The court date is set for Friday, January 23rd. McKee waived extradition, plans to plead not guilty. He's now facing 2 counts of aggravated murder with prior calculation and design. And in Ohio, that is death penalty eligible, but there is currently a moratorium on executions, but it don't mean you can't be sentenced to one. That's where we are. Monique Tepe spent 8 years building a life after Michael McKee, met Spencer online, married him in December 2020, private ceremony in their home during COVID, got 2 kids, by all accounts, happy, finally. She never said her ex-husband's name. Just called him ex-husband. The family says she was always worried. Nobody thought he'd actually do it. The police have his car on surveillance, arriving before the murders and leaving after. They have the ballistics match. They reportedly have an alibi that fell apart. And they may have witnesses who saw him in the neighborhood before December 30th. He's a surgeon who allegedly kept a murder weapon in his apartment. Reportedly talked to detectives when he should have stayed silent. Got an arrest at a Chick-fil-A on his way home from work. Smart enough to operate on human beings for a living. Allegedly not smart enough to ditch the gun. 8 years since the divorce. She moved on, built everything new. He apparently didn't. All right, let's continue this conversation off the air, shall we? Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or directly to me on our Substack. Check that out, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description. It's on the screen right now on YouTube if you're watching us there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening so you don't miss any of our reporting. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That's what you search on any platform. You will find us. And hit subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, a review. If you have a moment, if you're enjoying what we're doing, if you're finding this valuable, it's free. It takes a little bit of time, like 5 seconds. If you could spare those 5 seconds for us, if you're finding this valuable, to leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts, telling us your thoughts on our reporting. If you like it, we'd really appreciate that. Thank you for that in advance. All right, we'll continue this off the air in the comment section on Substack or YouTube. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.